Ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Michael Abram on behalf of my client, Michael Kurzman. As I'm sure your honors have read the brief, I believe that this case here today shows a clear lack of due process and fundamental fairness allowed to my client, Mr. Kurzman. Upon a review of the facts, the violation of probation that was filed in this case was a clear attempt to convict Mike Kurzman of a crime that he had not been charged with.
Was that the only citation for a violation of probation?
No, Your Honor. There were three other ones. One, he was found in violation of, to which the court said it played no part in their sentencing of Mr. Kurzman, and the other two, he was found not guilty of his other alleged violations.
So the record reflects that the only reason he was resentenced as a result of a violation of probation was because of this offense for which you complain.
Yes, Your Honor. Right at the at sentencing, my client spoke to the judge and was talking about the other technical violation that was submitted against him, and the court stated this played no part in his decision making. It was only the violation that the allegation that he had committed a new criminal act.
If, on the other hand, there was a violation that's sustainable by the record, could the court have modified the sentence in exactly the way it did in any event?
Well, Your Honor, this, if you look at the context of this, Mr. Kurzman was on probation for approximately 15 months. He was not found in violation before this point. 1 year at level 4, home confinement, followed by level 3, supervision. The only other violation would have been something in the matter of unsupervised contact with his children or not getting in a counseling program with the Department of Family Services. So I would say no, a 7 year, giving back every day of backed up time, 7 years, for a violation of that sort would seem to be excessive to me. The record reflects that the prosecution, given the weak nature of the other violations, the technical aspect of them in this new one, and the state's own admissions that they would not go forward on a criminal case because they could not prove it. They state that the alleged victim in this case is uncooperative, although they offered no testimony of this from anyone in any of these things, that she was uncooperative.
Wait a second. I must be thinking about a different record, because I thought that there was testimony from a person who had been a caseworker of some sort and ran into the alleged victim right after the injury took place, and that at that point she was frightened and said that she had been hit by your client. And that later on, when it came time to explain what happened, she said, "Oh no, we were throwing a football around, and I got hit in the face with a football, and you know, silly me, I got all upset about it." So, am I thinking about a different case, or is that the record here?
That is this case, Your Honor. I don't know if a revision of the story. If the testimony that was given that you're citing states that she was in a hysterical state, that she was, you know, very upset, and when words come out at that point, they could have come without a lot of forethought. And then later, when interviewed again by probation officers, is what you're referring to, she said that she was hit in the face with a football.
Isn't there also of record a fairly extensive history of the fact that, first of all, the wife or the ex-wife had problems with being assaulted by your client, and also, more significantly perhaps, had great concern because the Department of Social Services was indicating that if you, mother, don't take care of your children and get them out of this environment, we will take your children from you. And it seemed that there was a very strong suggestion that part of the reason that she would then try to explain any injury as being an accident is to avoid the consequences to her, not, you know, forgetting what it meant in terms of your client, but that if it were acknowledged that she had continued to put her children at risk in terms of where the contact with your client, that she would lose her children and that that was her reason for not being a cooperative witness. Isn't that all pretty much clearly of record?
No, Your Honor. Although the prosecutor in this case mentioned repeated events, she mentioned only the fact that there were arrests. She offered no evidence that Ms. Kersman was uncooperative in these other circumstances. And, in fact, one of the arrests that she alleges was taken to trial and resulted in a not guilty plea on one of the charges, directed verdict on the other one, so they never even got to the guilt or not guilty stage, and the other ones were nolliprossed. So the state actually consistently argues some facts which they offer no evidence for, and in fact the record shows did not occur. As proof of this, there's a 2001 incident that comes up where no one involved with that incident testified at all, no police officers who investigated it or anything to say what had happened, but they used that as a basis for prior abuse. There was one incident that was while he was on probation where the charges were nolliprossed without going to trial, and there was no evidence that Ms. Kersman didn't cooperate in anything at that point, and there's no evidence to indicate why the charges were nolliprossed. And the last one is the one I mentioned first, was the one where the charges were, he was either found not guilty, a directed verdict was entered, or a nolliprossed was given on the case.
And what about the evidence of the Division of Health and Social or Child Welfare, what I've forgotten the exact title, the concern about losing the children? Is that of record or not?
Your Honor, I believe the only evidence of that was given by the first witness who wasn't working on the case anymore. She was originally working beforehand, so I don't think that she would have been a competent witness to advise that the children were going to be pulled away at that point. There was another more testimony from Trini Parker, but if you look at the record and the testimony that was in there, she said she started allowing visitation because if you note, the actual sentencing order was amended early to allow him unsupervised visitation, which is one of the reasons that one of the violations couldn't be found because the court amended the order. So the Division of Family Services was allowing more visitation, supervised at first and then unsupervised. So the prosecution alleged it repeatedly, but I don't believe that the evidence actually bore out that this was about to happen to anyone.
What I get the impression from the briefing and what you said initially that you want us to make a bright line ruling that in Delaware, one who's accused of a criminal offense cannot be found in violation of probation unless they have been arrested and convicted of that offense. Is that correct or not?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if it's necessarily that definitive, but it seems to me that in this case in particular, the state made the decision that they could not prosecute him for this crime. So they chose the violation of probation route where certain protections would not be afforded to my client. The right to a trial by jury, the rules of evidence not being in place, and the burden of proof going from beyond a reasonable doubt to a preponderance of the evidence. So if there are other cases that we look back on.
Well, isn't it correct, and I'm going back to my years as a prosecutor, as a superior court judge, and as a defense attorney, trying to put it all together in one harmonious career, which is not that easy. But isn't it correct that it's always been the case that a condition of probation could be you not be arrested during the time of your probation? And that if you were, regardless of the outcome after the arrest, even if it was nolli prosequi, you could be found in violation of your probation. Would the result you want here change that as well?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that requirement would be unconstitutional on its face. Just to say that if a police officer happened to come by and arrest you, that your probation could be violated.
I mean, is that no longer a condition?
I believe the condition on this one is that you will not commit a new criminal offense. And I also do see.
Well, that's even less than being arrested.
Committing a new criminal offense?
Yeah. An allegation that you have committed a criminal offense doesn't necessarily contemplate you be arrested for it, does it? Or that you have a jury trial on it and be found guilty? It sounds to me like it contemplates a factual hearing before a judge with a preponderance of the evidence standard, and the judge concludes yes or no, you did or did not commit a criminal offense for the purposes of a violation of probation. And as long as you get the hearing as a probationer, given the lesser standard that applies to you as a probationer, what you give up as a result of having earlier committed an offense and being placed on probation, what's the due process violation?
Well, Your Honor, I think in the context of this case in particular, The state goes so far as to allege that this conduct is felonious. So if the state is so interested in, and the impassioned pleas at opening and closing about how he's a serial abuser over and over again, it seems to me that if the state was so interested that they would have filed new charges against him, but they were incapable of it, so they went to the lower standard. And I think that...
Well, I guess what I'm trying to understand is when you say they went to the lower standard, what's objectionable about that given his probationer status?
Because the essential purpose of this violation was to convict him of a new crime. If the court wanted to violate his probation for what he was doing on probation, I think that to violate someone for committing a new crime when you're
he
not
didn't a get a greater sentence than that which was held over his head as a result of being on probation in the first place, did he?
No, Your Honor. He didn't. He got the maximum, he got every day back on his first violation after being out on probation for 15 months, which, as Your Honor looked back on his own experience previously, I'm sure Your Honor would recall that this does not typically happen, that typically probationers are given a chance, a lesser sentence than every single day back on their first violation of probation.
Let's help me focus on your argument here, because there's a distinction between never prosecuting the person and the deficiencies or alleged deficiencies at the violation of probation hearing. In this case, the prosecution would have been her testimony, and she didn't want to testify against him, so the state had no case. But the state had these other witnesses who they called at the probation hearing. So put aside why the state did or didn't prosecute him criminally, what were the deficiencies in the evidence that you challenged at the violation of probation hearing?
Well, Your Honor, I believe in this case was just made aware for me that the case of Collins that was just decided by this court in March. If you look at that case, I believe it's similar in this case that hearsay evidence was the only real evidence used to prosecute Mr. Kersman. The first witness saying that Ms. Kersman came in and said things to her was the basis that the court used.
Didn't the court find that it was an excited utterance and therefore an exception to the hearsay rule?
Yeah, I believe in I just got Collins today that even if it is an exception to the hearsay rule, that it was deemed not to be enough to just based purely on hearsay to convict someone of a violation of probation.
One distinguishing feature is, as I understood it, the victim in this case on appeal went into a restaurant or a commercial establishment, and the caseworker who knew the victim could see her injuries and see that there was more than one injury and draw their conclusion, I know which you challenged in another part of your brief about being improper medical testimony, but testified that the multiple injuries were inconsistent with a single striking by a football. So at least those observations wouldn't have been hearsay. Is that correct?
Well, as you stated, though, aside from the aspects of getting those admitted as expert testimony in a typical trial, no, the fact that the probation officer said it looked like there was multiple points, but as was pointed out in the testimony, he has no medical training, and for him to determine that it was hit by a fist instead of a football is purely speculation on his part.
But probably we could take judicial notice that if you're struck once with a football, it probably only hits one part of your body, doesn't it?
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. If you got hit with a point and then it bounced forward, then I would say there could be 2 points of contact. Or even the laces on a football, if they scratched across your face, depending on how you were hit, that you could have more than one point of trauma.
Let's agree with that, and let's agree that they're all within 8 inches of your face. If you have injuries to other parts of your body, probably just a jury is asked to bring its common sense to bear on things, so we ask fact finders to bring their common sense. You wouldn't expect to see injuries on other parts of your body other than your face if you're hit in the face with a football, would you?
Well, Your Honor, the explanation offered by Ms. Kersman was rough sex, if I believe, and I don't believe that there's any allegations from the witness in the restaurant that said that she had seen any marks on her at any other point, or that when she's recanting what Ms. Kersman allegedly said to her, that Ms. Kersman stated that she was being held or that there would have been injuries to any other part of her.
Okay. Well, we're using up your rebuttal time.
Did you want to save the balance of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
You might think about for your rebuttal, too, by the way, just to help both you and your colleague, think about Collins in terms of why this case is at oral argument in the first place. So spend some time talking about Collins and how it relates to this case when you come back.
Thank you, Your Honor.
afternoon. Excuse me. May it please the court. My name is Kim Avazian, and I represent the state in this matter. First and foremost, we're talking about a violation of probation proceeding here, not a jury trial. And as the court is aware, a person who is admitted to probation after having been convicted of a crime is on conditional liberty and has to obey the conditions of his or her probation.
What was the evidence in this case that the defendant committed the crime?
The evidence in this case was the testimony of Robin Williams, who was the former counselor at DFS, who witnessed the victim, Mr. Kersman's wife, Leah, run into a restaurant, bleeding and clutching her child, her young child, saying, "Don't let him come in, don't let him come in," hysterical and crying. And immediately thereafter, Mr. Kersman comes in. And Robin Williams testified that the victim said in her presence to her child, "You know, tell Miss Robin, Daddy hit her." And I think when you consider not only the victim's statements, her statements which she told to Miss Williams, and also her statements to the two probation officers who visited her 3 days later, you have competent evidence here of her, of who was the perpetrator of this assault.
Now, what would have happened at a criminal trial if the state had presented that same evidence?
Well, at a criminal trial, you've got, again, the situation where you have an out-of-court statement. These are hearsay statements that the judge found were admitted under or could be admitted under the hearsay exceptions of a present sense of impression and an excited utterance. I mean, you have some situation where you're talking about the gentleman was under probation and there would have to be, I guess, a careful delineation of the testimony. But assuming that...
And where are those two exceptions in the law now after the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Crawford?
I don't believe these would... certainly the initial statements, when she's coming racing in, these are not testimonial statements. She apparently didn't even recognize... She didn't recognize Robin Williams until Robin Williams said, "You know, Leah, is that you?" And she had already been coming in crying. So I don't think we have a Crawford problem here.
So they come in as non-testimonial statements. If the state has no other evidence at a criminal trial, have they established his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, again, I think that you have at trial that higher level of burden of proof on the state, and here we're dealing with a violation of probation proceeding where we have a lower level of proof, and that is the preponderance of the evidence. So, again, you know, at trial we have a different situation, but what we're dealing with here is a violation of probation proceeding where what Mr. Kersman is entitled to is, according to the due process clause and Superior Court Rule 32.1, the minimum requirements of due process, which he was given.
How would you distinguish this case from Collins?
In Collins, I think one of the main distinctions is that neither the victim or the other witnesses, the police officer testified in Collins, and he said he had talked to the victim, he had talked to, I believe it was the victim's mother or
aunt.
Aunt,
as I recall. I'd be wrong.
And neither of those individuals testified at the hearing either. So you have Leah Kersman testifying here. Granted, she spoke on behalf of the defendant. But, I mean, she did not... Her testimony was not credible. The judge found that her testimony was not credible. But among the other things she said, well... I just, I was upset because he hit me and he laughed at me. She was not really trying to deny what she had said, but she was trying to say, well, you know, I wasn't really coming out and saying what really happened. And she spoke to the probation officers, yes, 3 days later, and denied that she had said this. She said it was an accidental injury that occurred while she was playing football with her husband, while they were arguing about her infidelities. So, and then at the probation hearing, she said, well, we were playing football with the dog, and it bounced off the fence and hit me in the face, and he laughed at me, and I ran. Right? She was all over the place. And I think in this case, you have the alleged victim of the assault, who is clearly not a credible witness. You have people who have no motivation to lie, a former employee, a former counselor at DFS, no motive to make this up or exaggerate this. And you have a judge hearing all this evidence and making a determination. And the state believes this is competent evidence on which to base a finding of violation of probation. As far as the probation, the argument was raised that the prosecutor was had no record. I think no record of the prior arrests or other victims' prior incidents of lack of cooperation. I think you have probation officers who testified about her lack of cooperation in previous incidents, and I think you can take judicial notice of the family court records and indications where the victim, Mrs. Kirstman, refused to appear. I don't believe that the state can be in this sort of relaxed informal proceeding held to provide every single piece of evidence to support statements which, as an officer of the court, she's making to the court.
Well, the concern here is that it's one thing to say there appears to be a history of non-cooperation. And what the argument here is, there seems to be a history of abuse, and he should be sentenced for his violation of probation because this is the latest in a long history of abuse or domestic violence.
Well, they have a very long, they have several years, apparently, of working with, as being clients of Division of Family Services, and you do certainly have the offense for which he was on probation, which was a guilty plea to assault second, of his wife in front of three children. And so I think what you have to consider is, by way of background information, the state was trying to explain to the judge why Leah was going to get on the stand and say what she was going to say, which was, he hit me accidentally with a football. So this was not so much a finding of or trying to taint the defendant, or excuse me, the probationer, with, you know, bad prior bad acts, as explaining you have a domestic violence situation where the victim is constantly or frequently changing her statements. So I think, again, you have to consider what is the context in which this all takes place, and to look at what the requirements were, the requirements of due process, which is what was afforded Mr. Kirstman. He had an attorney. He had notice of the charges against him, the allegations of violation against him. He was able to call witnesses on his behalf. He was able to question witnesses who were adverse to him. And all this, you know, was in a setting of a contested VOP. And the trial judge, the Superior Court judge then found, on the basis of testimony from several individuals who were there, who had seen the victim when she came immediately thereafter after being assaulted, and several days later. So I think this is a very different case from the Collins case, where there was just hearsay and nothing else. And the court also distinguished it by finding that this was hearsay that came under certain well-established hearsay exceptions.
Well, in Collins, as I recall, didn't the police officer go to the scene and see evidence of a burglary, broken property, which tended to corroborate the hearsay that he took from the victim and the other family members?
There was that corroboration. I think what was lacking was a connection between the physical evidence of a break-in or of a burglary and the probationer himself. Whereas here you have a situation where immediately after she runs into this restaurant, he follows and asks, who's that? Because Robin Williams is there trying to help his wife. And you have a situation where immediately thereafter, she returns home, he follows, Robin Williams can see them, and then she goes off to a different area, a different development. So when the police arrive, called by Robin Williams, they're able to contact her other than by telephone. So it's I think when you look at the circumstances, the factual circumstances here, and you review the record as to the evidence, you had testimony from two DFS workers, one former Robin Williams and one current Trini Parker, and you have testimony from three probation officers, including the probation officer who had as his client Mr. Kurzman previously in the years before. And you see that not only were there technical violations alleged, but he had committed some minor traffic violations, which did not necessarily require a violation. But this is a situation where he had been allowed conditional liberty, and the Division of Family Services was working with him and his family, and there were instances where he did not cooperate with them. There were instances where he was definitely arrested on previous charge or another charge that never went beyond the dismissal and then a finding of not guilty in family court as far as the terroristic threatening is concerned. But I think it's clear that this was a family situation that created, shall we say, where the victim was not cooperative and there were all kinds of difficulties in pursuing prosecutions. But
the appellant contends that the sentence was severe, and that's because the judge sentenced his client, sentenced the appellant, with a closed mind, as the term of art that we often apply to review sentences on the rare occasion when we do. What's your response to that argument?
I mean, a closed mind, as this court has defined it, is some sort of preconceived bias against the defendant and or the probationer in this case, that would be. And I really don't see how one can make that argument a bias when, in fact, the Superior Court judge did not find him in violation on two of the allegations. I mean, he was looking at the evidence, listening to the evidence, and fairly and objectively deciding whether or not there was sufficient evidence of a violation on the four allegations that were there. Two, he said, no, there's no violation here. So to say that there's some sort of preconceived bias against this gentleman is hard to even conceive from the record before it, and I don't think the appellant has pinpointed anything other than to say this, you know, was a severe sentence for a first violation. But again, I mean, he was, as Your Honor points out, not sentenced to anything more than the unexecuted portion of his original sentence for assault, second, and three counts of endangering the welfare of a child. And the judge was certainly within its authority to reimpose that suspended portion of his sentence. The fact that this was his first violation, again, the situation was there was a previous violation that was alleged and withdrawn after the family court proceeding was dismissed. But clearly, from the testimony, all was not well with this family, and they were having disputes that would be resolved, and there was some lack of communication, as the Superior Court judge noted, between DFS and the probation officers. And so at this point, where there was clearly sufficient competent evidence to find a violation, where the wife was beaten and bloody and the child was there while this was going on, at this point, certainly there's no abuse of discretion on the Superior Court judge's part in reimposing the suspended portion of his sentence. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you very much.
In hearing Ms. Avazian's comments, one thing that really struck me was that she asked the court to take judicial notice of the family court record. Just off the top of my head, asking the court to take notice of records that aren't even presented in the hearing would go just to a ridiculous extent to ask the court later things that aren't even brought up to use as evidence to convict anyone. In response to the court's questions about the excessive sentencing, if you look at the misconduct that was put in, the misconduct I'm alleging against the prosecutor, where she's bringing up event after event after event with no actual evidence put forward, and then you look at what the judge did in his language when he says prior assaults, and I believe he uses the plural more than once, either the judge relied upon this evidence with no factual basis in his sentence, or he got information from somewhere else to use to believe that prior assaults had occurred. So I don't believe that the evidence that was presented, which, again, there was no testimony from an officer who investigated a previous event, there was no evidence from a DFS worker who had actually interviewed Ms. Kurzman about a previous event. It was all the prosecutor stating he was arrested before, and she didn't cooperate, so he was guilty of assaults before, and he has a history of a batterer. Even with the lack of rules of evidence and the informality of the hearing, I don't believe that should stand up as any kind of actual evidence to be used by the court in sentencing. In response to the court's questions about Collins, I think that a parallel can be drawn with Collins with this case when you look at but for the police officer's testimony, or in this case the probation officer's testimony, the physical evidence doesn't amount to anything. In Collins, you look at the broken furniture or the evidence of a break-in, and the police officer can connect that and make a nexus to say, okay, because of this hearsay testimony, I believe that, you know, and this evidence backs up the hearsay testimony to show that he committed this crime. I think it's similar in this case, where if you go, okay, we have a woman with marks on her face, but without the testimony, the hearsay testimony of the former DFS worker, you've got no nexus to connect that injury to anything with Mr. Kurzman.
Well, wait a second. We do, because Ms. Kurzman said that she got hit in the face by a football that was thrown by Mr. Kurzman. So although the way she received those injuries may be in dispute, the fact that he was the one who caused the injury is not in dispute. There's direct testimony from the victim, right?
But
so the only question here is whether the court's going to believe that explanation for the admitted injury and your client's participation in that injury, or whether, based upon other evidence that's presented, the court is going to reach a conclusion that no, your client caused that injury in a malicious way and not an accidental way.
I don't know if using the negative inference to believe that he was the one who caused a physical injury intentionally is the way that it would the best way to go about it. If Ms. Kurzman had never testified, and she did not testify in any way saying that Mr. Kurzman had hit her. So if she had...
Well, didn't she say that he threw the football at her?
He said the football was kicked and it hit her, yes.
Okay, so he has been linked, by direct testimony, he has been linked to this injury, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but without the hearsay testimony, there is no evidence at all that it was a criminal act or any criminal intent involved. So without that, I think you can get to the nexus that some activity occurred, but without the hearsay statements, I don't believe you can show that any criminal activity actually occurred. I guess if there are no other questions, I'll call it a day.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise.